And we continue our conversation on the American buffalo with Rosalyn LaPierre. She's an ethnobotanist and an indigenous writer. LaPierre is an enrolled member of the Blackfeet of Montana and Métis, and she's a professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She is featured prominently throughout the American Buffalo documentary. I spoke with LaPierre in October at a live event in the Collins Studio at Illinois Public Media in Urbana. Professor LaPierre, welcome to the 21st show. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is probably your 400th conversation on the American buffalo in the past few months. How were you approached to participate in this project? Does Ken Burns show up on your caller ID?
Close. So I was approached. So Ken Burns is part of Florentine Films. So Florentine Films is his nonprofit organization that creates the films that they do. So I actually was contacted by Florentine Films. That's what showed up on my... So I was contacted by one of the co-producers. So one of his main co-producers, which we saw in the clip, is Julie Dunphy. And so Julie Dunphy contacted me and asked me if I was interested in serving both as an advisor, but also be interviewed for this film. And that was more than maybe 2.5 years ago, at least.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a long process. Talk about that. What goes into that from that first phone call until you're actually sitting down in a studio with beautiful lighting, being photographed in that distinctive Ken Burns way?
So the first thing you need to remember is that this film was produced and filmed, and the interviews were all done during COVID. So I've never done a documentary film before, ever. So my only experience is this experience. But apparently, normally, everybody would always get together as a team. And we had a lot of meetings that were virtual that would have been live had it been in a different situation. And then when the filming was done, there was really, really strict protocols about testing and making sure that everybody was healthy when that time came. But what happens usually first is we got the script. And of course, the script is always longer than what ends up in the film. And so the first, in academia, we say peer review, right? So the first peer review was us reading the script and then making comments as to what we thought was a good trajectory to go or not, or just whatever we wanted to say, really. And so as advisors, we really had freedom to say whatever we wanted to. There was no sort of editing or disagreeing with what we said. So we were always able to, through that process, have our input made. So first we saw the script. Then people were interviewed, and they also went out to Montana. So 2 summers ago, in 2021.
Burns talks about that, walking with you.
Yeah. Well, that was this summer.
Okay.
But yeah. So 2 summers ago, they went out to mostly Montana, but also other places in the West. So Oklahoma, the Dakotas. And so most of the footage that's in this film is actually filmed in Montana. So it's filmed at... The Bison Range, which is on the Salish Kootenai Reservation. It's filmed at a place called American Prairie, which is a privately owned bison herd. It's filmed at Yellowstone. And then there was a lot of the background shots, which are also called B-roll, right? A lot of that was done in different places in Montana, but also, like I said, in kind of Oklahoma and the Dakotas as well. So that was all done pretty much 2 years ago. And then starting 2 years ago in the summer, they started individually interviewing everybody. And then after a few months and they put together the pieces, we got to see the first rough cut.
Yeah.
And so the first rough cut was sent to us and it's kind of like embargoed. Like we couldn't see it until they literally sent the email, and then we were allowed to see it, and we were like not supposed to share it with anybody or show anybody. And it's a rough cut. So if you've ever seen a rough cut of a film, a rough cut doesn't have all the photographs in it. They still don't have permission, like with some of the historic photographs. And so a lot of it is just black. and it has words that say they're going to put thus and
picture
such here.
Picture of bison here.
Exactly.
Yes.
and there's not even music. And what you're hearing is the interviews and stuff like that. So
it's a rough way to consume Ken Burns.
Yes, yeah. So the first... the first thing we saw was all of that. And then again, People were able to make comments and stuff. It wasn't until we saw a later rough cut that we had a meeting with all of the advisors, and it was a 4-day meeting virtually.
Oh my gosh.
I know. And they waited till really the last minute because they kept thinking we might be able to have this in person. We might be able to get everybody together, which, again, normally they do. Everybody gets in the same room and sort of watches the rough cut slowly and then makes comments and we have a conversation. We ended up doing that same thing, but all virtually. So that was it for me. That was an interesting kind of process to be part of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you know what you were getting into?
Absolutely not. No idea.
Any regrets?
No.
Okay. One of the other interviewees in the American Buffalo talks about history and time, and that Indigenous people have lived here for 600 generations is what they said. That is a deep well of time. I wonder how that informs how you think about time.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, when I think of the history of this place, I think of, as you guys will see in the film, there's a mention of how short amount of time that, you know, the United States has existed and how short of a time that this has been a country. And for, you know, Indigenous people, we can look back to thousands and thousands of years of history in this area, in North America. And so our thinking about place and our relationship with those places really has a longer, deeper relationship and connection. And the history of the United States is so short because it's just over 200 years. And it's sort of, you're talking about that compared to thousands of years that people may have been in one particular place.
So the film obviously talks a lot about the European devastation of the bison population over time. And I don't know, we can talk a little bit about that, but I also wonder if you can maybe just speak to, as the bison, as the buffalo are being hunted to extinction, how did Indigenous people keep the idea of the buffalo alive, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I think what's really interesting about the story of the bison, and you'll see it in the film as well, there's a lot of different Indigenous people that are part of this film, and we saw a few of them already today, but and they all kind of share similar stories about the importance of bison in their religion and their religious practice. So even as the bison were being hunted to near extinction, it was still part of Indigenous religion. And throughout, you know, the end of the 19th century into the 20th century, people were still practicing their same religion and religious practice and their, you know, rituals and ceremonies. And bison was part of that. So even when there weren't physically bison there, it was still an important part of religion. Then, you know, fast forward to kind of the end of the 20th century and today in the 21st century, when there are much larger bison herds that tribes can now, instead of like borrowing, because a lot of times when people were doing rituals, they were literally like borrowing somebody's bison and killing it versus having their own. Mm-hmm. That now most tribes today who want to have bison have them. They're able to kill the bison themselves, the ones that they need to use as part of rituals, and use those today. So that whole time period when there were no physical bison, people were still practicing the religion without the bison there. So that's an important kind of story to tell of kind of that continuation that happened. So even though they were physically gone, and that was really abrupt, an abrupt thing that happened for a lot of Indigenous communities, that didn't mean that people stopped praying or stopped, you know, their religious practice. They didn't. They continued that on throughout the 20th century.
Yeah. And as we see in the film, Indigenous people have played a big role in helping the buffalo recover, the populations recover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so one of the stories that's told in this is, and one of the reasons why part of this documentary was filmed on the Salish Kootenai Reservation is that the Salish Kootenai people played a really significant role in saving some of the last bison that were on the Northern Great Plains. And they kept them and grew a really large, well, back in those days, a really large herd, and were able to then share those bison with other ranches as they got, as the herds got bigger. So all of those were a really slow process. But as you'll see in the film, there's lots of different folks that participated, from farmers, ranchers, conservationists, indigenous people, who all were individually working to revive the bison herds until sort of collectively there was, a larger population. Yeah.
Is there a lesson from that effort, the slow recovery of the bison population, for some of the other ecological challenges that humans are confronting with our warming planet and in, you know, global weirding, these crazy storms we're getting? We've just been through the hottest summer on record, and it may be the coolest summer any of us live through for the rest of our lives. What are some of the lessons we can draw from that?
So, yeah, I mean, I think that in this particular case, you know, it was individuals who just decided, you know, I'm going to do this. And as you'll see in the film, it's really interesting because a lot of times when it was ranchers who often get the credit in history, that it was actually their wives that were the ones that said, I want to save these bison, you know, let's go get these four calves and I'm going to keep them. And that they were the ones that, you know, kind of were the had the passion. But I mean, I think one of the things that it says is that, you know, a lot of individuals working separately can create change. And then ultimately it becomes a collective, that collectively then the change happens. So,
yeah. Let me reintroduce my guest. Rosalyn LaPierre is an indigenous writer, environmental historian, and ethnobotanist. She's an enrolled member of the Blackfeet of Montana. She's also Métis, and she's a professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's featured prominently throughout Ken Burns' latest documentary, The American Buffalo. I spoke with her in October in front of a live audience in the Collins Studio at Illinois Public Media in Urbana. We're going to continue our conversation with Professor LaPierre when we return. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to the conclusion of my conversation recorded in October with Rosalyn LaPierre. She is an indigenous writer, an environmental historian, and an ethnobotanist. She's an enrolled member of the Blackfeet of Montana. She's Métis, and she's professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She was featured prominently in Ken Burns' latest documentary called The American Buffalo, which is available now to stream on the PBS Passport app. I spoke with her in October at a live event in the Collins Studio at Illinois Public Media. Can you talk more broadly about the relationship between indigenous people and the natural world?
One of the things I'd say is, so indigenous people have been in North America, depending on the science that you look at, anywhere between 30 and 33,000 years ago to the latest research that just came out with the footprints that they found down in what is now North New Mexico, 20 to 23,000 years ago. They were in that area that long ago, so they were here much longer. So, indigenous people have been here again for thousands of years. And over that thousands of years, not only have indigenous people evolved to be a lot of different ethnic groups, a lot of different languages, a lot of different religious traditions. And so because of that, and where people live. So when people establish themselves in a particular ecosystem, their relationship to that ecosystem really informed their culture, informed their religion. And so that is then how they kind of developed as a human society. Indigenous people, no matter where they are, do have, you know, a long relationship with the place that they call home. And almost always their relationship to the natural world is almost always viewed through a religious lens. It's almost always that they have some sort of cosmology that tells them what their relationship is to the natural world, to the universe, and then that's how they interact and create relationships with the plant kingdom or the animal kingdom and other human societies. So I don't know of an indigenous community that doesn't put religion first as the way that they relate to the world around them.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that the buffalo is sacred, as we just saw in that excerpt, but it's not sacrosanct, right? It is consumed. It's a symbiotic relationship. Can you talk about that distinction? Because there are other world cultures that do treat certain animals as sacrosanct. You cannot eat a cow in certain Indian religious traditions, for example.
Yeah, so I'll just say this. It depends on the tribe and the indigenous community. What, again, their story is, what is their origin story of how bison came to be an animal that humans eat, right? And so almost always when there is something of importance, an animal that's important that is part of their food system, a plant that's important that's part of their medicine or their food, there's almost always some sort of origin story or origin myth that says why humans are using that particular animal, that particular plant. And so again, depending on the tradition, those stories are different. And I can share with what the Blackfeet think. Mm-hmm. So our origin stories are really, really long. So this is like the very short, succinct version.
Cliff notes.
Yes. So the origin story of where bison came from. So the Blackfeet, first of all, in their belief system, they believe that there are three separate parallel worlds. They believe there's an underwater world, they believe there's Earth, and they believe there's a sky world. And these are three separate places where humans can live, where deities live, where animals that aren't truly animals live, plants live, and that these three places are places that are permeable in that deities can move from place to place, humans can move from place to place, and so can animals. For the most part, but not necessarily, humans live on Earth. They don't have to only live on Earth. But the things that humans end up using almost always come from a different realm, and it's almost always introduced to humans through the deities of that realm. Mm-hmm. So for the bison, the Blackfeet, as the story goes, the Blackfeet historically had been vegetarian. They only lived on plants. They had a plant-based diet. There's a long story short, there's a child that emerges that a family adopts and takes care of. And this family adopts and takes care of this child. It turns out that that child is actually the child of a bison who turned into a human. The grandfather of the child finally finds this child and realizes that this family's been taking care of them. They invite the family down to the underwater realm. So they bring them down to the underwater realm as humans, meet them, feast them, welcome them sort of into the bison world, and then basically say as a thank you for showing kindness to this our grandson, we're going to give you some of the bison. And in the same story, give some dogs as well. So there's these underwater dogs that then bark and chase some of the underwater bison out from underneath a lake. They run out onto the prairies. And by coming out from underneath the water, they stop being supernatural. bison and they become animal bison. And so in that process, they transform themselves and become animals. And then the underwater realm bison have to teach the humans how to hunt and kill them. Again, long story short, this is how the bison become part of the Blackfeet food system. And so as part of that process, then there is rituals involved and ceremonies involved that before the Blackfeet can kill a bison or eat a bison, they have to basically thank the underwater bison for allowing them to kind of sacrifice themselves or give themselves as a gift to human society. So that's one story of how sort of bison got to be part of human food systems. But as part of that, because they are a gift, then there's always kind of reciprocity that has to be part of that gift giving. So of one of the things that occurs that we think of today as traditional ecological knowledge is understanding how the ecosystem of bison habitat works. And so one of the things then that the Blackfeet were charged with was also taking care of the habitat. So that they had to take care of the grasslands, they had to take care of the food that the bison eat as well. And so that is also taught to them in this whole process. So it's not just, you know, now you get to eat bison and then you pray, you know, and you thank them for, but you also have to create the habitat where the bison can live a healthy life as well.
If it's not too personal, did you grow up with these stories?
I did, yes.
Yeah.
So when I grew up primarily on the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana, and I was raised living in my grandparents' home most of the time. So I learned from both my grandmother and my grandfather on the Blackfeet side of my family about most of this. Yeah.
Yeah. You've done now, I guess, dozens at least of events related to this documentary. It hasn't even aired yet.
And I have another one later this week.
my condolences. Thank you for being here. You know, a lot of academics can go their entire career without getting this sort of recognition for their knowledge and expertise. I wonder what that's been like for you.
I'll just say I didn't realize until the promotion started. And first of all, I didn't realize that they even promoted these films. I was always on the watching end of it. So way back in May, so for those of you who haven't seen it, but if I encourage you to see it if you haven't, the PBS NewsHour with Judy Woodruff did a special on this film and interviewed a few of us as part of that. And you can watch it on
PBS Passport if you are a member and supporter of your local public TV station. Yes.
So it's available online. And it's about an hour long. That was filmed in May. So that was the beginning. And so my first entry point into the promotion was Judy Woodruff.
That's fascinating. I just watched that last night, as a matter of fact. So that was in May.
Was in May.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't, on a maybe more serious note, you teach now at a university that until 2007 had a student in indigenous, quasi-indigenous regalia at sporting events. I wonder what changes you've seen in specifically the Academy's relationship with Native American and Indigenous history and people.
That's a multi-part answer to that question. So the Academy itself, so in the last 20 plus years, so, you know, the 21st century, in the last 20 plus years, there definitely has been a huge change in the number of people who, for example, are getting degrees in environmental history. And a lot of folks who study environmental history also end up studying Native American history, and then also folks studying Native American history. So there's just a lot more scholars out there now today where this is a field of study that people are doing scholarship in. And students who are now, you know, interested in learning and studying, again, this kind of intersection between environmental and Native American history. That's different than the beginning of your question. The beginning of your question. So yeah, so, you know, the University of Illinois has a long sort of tainted history that it still has not addressed or recovered from.
So you can still buy the t-shirts
downtown.
Yeah,
so I've only been here a year as a new faculty member in the history department. And really my first experience on campus was being, you know, having chief regalia people. I went to a football game and it was everywhere. It's not gone. It's on this campus. It's something you can see on a daily basis. And I think for Native American students, and they've expressed this numerous times, and for Native American faculty like myself, that really constitutes, you know, us kind of being in a hostile kind of work environment and a hostile learning environment when you can see it every single day. It's brand, like you said, you can buy it downtown, you can buy it online. It's easy to find. Even like last year when we were having the springtime, I can't remember what they're called, but when students come to campus with their families that got admitted, there were entire families walking around campus with chief gear on, entire families. So it's there. And so until the university says no more, like we're not going to allow this to continue, we're going to stop selling the license for people to be able to buy that kind of gear, and for the university to think of it more as hate speech and hate t-shirts and hats and whatever, I think that that's not going to get solved. And it's still going to be really uncomfortable for Native students and Native faculty. I was in an event earlier this week because it was Indigenous Peoples Day, and it was something that one of our alumni, a student who just graduated, said pretty much my same experience was they never went to any kind of sporting events, because every sporting event you go to, there's going to be chief regalia there. And it makes it uncomfortable for Native students and they feel unsafe. In fact, this student said that they sometimes were afraid to go to events, and we shouldn't be an institution where students are afraid to even go to a sporting event. And that's what we are. And so until the institution actually addresses that head on and just says no more, we're not going to allow this anymore, and we're going to be a safe, inclusive place, as Ken Burns said, that's going to be something that we have not sort of, you know, made a complete break with that past.
Yeah. So. Thank you for speaking candidly about that. Professor Rosalyn LaPierre, thank you so much for being with us on the 21st show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thank you to everyone for coming. Rosalyn LaPierre is a professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's an ethnobotanist and an indigenous writer, an enrolled member of the Blackfeet of Montana, and also Métis. She is featured prominently in the newest documentary from Ken Burns. It's called The American Buffalo. It's available to stream now on the PBS Passport app. That's all the time we have for our show today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.